I'm Tom Hall. Welcome to Midday. Today, a conversation about some of the black women intellectuals who've influenced the civil rights movements for race and gender equality. Women like Mary Church Terrell and Pauli Murray. Their scholarship and activism are often overshadowed by that of black men and white feminists. In this edition of the Midday Culture Connection, we'll explore the achievements and influence of these women with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland and Dr. Brittany Cooper of Rutgers University. Cooper's latest book is Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. We'll also talk to a modern-day race woman, Ellen G. of Baltimore Ceasefire, who's working to stem the tide of homicide in Baltimore. Midday gets underway right after these headlines. Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you've decided to join us today for Midday. Today, it's another installment of the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. Sherry is an associate professor in the Department of American Studies at the university. She's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Sherry, always a pleasure.
Hi, how are you?
Doing fine, thanks. And we are joined on the line from Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, by Dr. Brittany Cooper. She's an assistant professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Africana Studies at Rutgers, and the author of a new book that we're going to talk about today called Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. Dr. Cooper, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Cooper's book explores the history of black women intellectuals. The 19th and 20th century race women that she tells us about are often thought of as activists rather than public intellectuals. Their scholarship and achievements are often overshadowed by the work of black men like W.E.B. Du Bois, Frederick Douglass, and others, as well as the writing and activism of early white feminists. A little later in the program, we'll be joined by Ellen G., whom we might call a contemporary race woman. She's one of the organizers behind the Baltimore Ceasefire, an attempt to put a stop to the terrible level of violence that has plagued our city, particularly since the death of Freddie Gray in 2015. She and other organizers are calling for no violence in Baltimore for 72 hours this weekend. But first, we turn to Sherry Parks and Brittany Cooper to talk about the history and influence of some of the important early black women intellectuals and how their thought evolved from the end of the 1800s through the mid to late 20th century. And as we do that, we welcome your questions and comments. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wipr.org. And if you'd like to join us on Twitter, that'd be fine, @MiddayTomHall. So, Brittany Cooper, the term race woman was a new term to me. Tell us what you mean by that.
Sure. So, race woman is a way that black women intellectuals and activists were referred to beginning in the late 19th century. And it really refers to these very prominent public black women who were committed to the struggle for African-American equality, who did work in African-American communities to try to uplift those communities in the aftermath of slavery and Reconstruction, and who loved blackness and black people. And so their race-first ethic was really central to their politics and to their thought leadership. At the same time, thinking about them as being race women matters in terms of thinking about the politics of what it meant to try to lead alongside a group of people who always put forth men as the sort of leaders of the race and the kind of go-to figures for thinking about how to help black people to racially advance. And so it's a way to think about black women leaders in a particular era.
And in the prologue to your book, you write that many black women scholars labor under the exigencies of historical triage. And you have a beautiful turn of phrase. You say that their names exist almost like family photos relegated to a wall that we barely touch. What do you mean by historical triage?
Sure. So what I mean is that we have had a couple of decades of wonderful work from black women's historians to recover a lot of these black women whose names we don't know as well, Anna Julia Cooper, Mary Church Terrell, Pauli Murray, and some other women whom I discuss in the book. So we have done this recovery work, and in that way, my discussion of these women is not new. However, what we haven't done after saying they came, they saw, they acted, and they had an impact on history is we still haven't talked a lot about the content of the things that they said, particularly around their intellectual work. And so for me, that's the kind of work of triage, right? We were worried, early Black women historians were worried that we would forget these women, that they would be lost to the annals of history. So they made sure that that didn't happen, but now it's time for scholars who are coming through the ranks to do an additional round of work with these women, which is to say, well, what is the content of their contributions, and how have they actually shaped the story of African-American lives in the 19th and 20th century, which are the time periods that I focus on in this book. So how do we move them from the sort of patchwork of triage, the rescue work of triage, to really saying they matter and they're impactful, and it's not just enough to know their names. We also need to know something substantive about what they've contributed.
Yeah, and your book certainly makes a big contribution to that. And Sherry Parks, your book, Back in the Day, and we talked about that 7 years ago.
The first edition. It's the second one.
You talk, and of course, it's right in the title, Fierce Angels. You talk about how there's long been an association of fierceness with Blackness. Is that particularly acute with women, do you think? I mean, is it any different between women and men and the perceptions that people have?
Well, it's interesting, and Brittany uses the word fearless, and I think in some ways we're talking about a very similar thing.
Mm-hmm.
And as Brittany points out in her work, and it's interesting because Brittany has reviewed Fierce Angels. She's known about it for a long time. The idea that and she talks about this, that Black women have been able to move into spaces differently than Black men. And so anybody has the ability to be fierce, but who gets to be fierce and how they get to orchestrate it is different. And certainly within the gender sphere, the gender question, Black women have moved in ways that their contemporary white women did not, could not.
And Brittany Cooper, let's talk about some of these women that you write about in the book. The first is Anna Julia Cooper, who happens coincidentally to share your last name, but I guess not a relation.
Right.
And you sought out to sort of examine the work of several people sort of through the lens that Anna Julia Cooper provides you. Why is she important to history in general and to you in particular?
Sure. So Dr. Anna Julia Cooper is one of the first Black women to get her PhD, which she receives in 1925. But as early as the 1890s, she is the first Black woman to write a collection of political essays that really center Black women's gender concerns as a core racial issue that should be animating the work of Black politics. So before she wrote A Voice from the South, her 1892 book, which was a collection of both essays and speeches that she had been giving to audiences in the D.C. area and beyond, we didn't have a Black woman's political perspective put forth that forthrightly in the ways that she had done it. And so she has become a model for how we think about Black feminist work, how we think about the relationship of race and gender in Black women's lives. And I wanted to argue that she is a significant and important theorist, that she's not just a sort of important educator and an important figure that we should celebrate, but there's content to her thought, that there's a way that she sees Black women's bodies and Black women's lives as a site of possibility, and there's a way in which she sees Black women as at the core of the struggle for racial freedom that has always been inspiring to me since I first read the work, but that I think is a really important intellectual contribution as we think about what does it mean for Black, ultimately this question of what does it mean for Black people to be free, and what she argues is there is no Black freedom without making sure that Black women are free. And that continues to be a provocative idea even today. So I wanted to go back to one of the earliest Black women who makes that kind of claim and then use her as a way to then think about the Black women colleagues that she works with during that time period, because they're all working together as this sort of amazing force of Black women to advance this idea that Black women are critical to the Black Freedom Project.
And Sherry Parks, I mean, do we, or perhaps should we, or even how should we engage Black women intellectuals of the 19th century, the early 20th century, the people like Fannie Barrier Williams, whom Brittany Cooper writes about, or Polly Murray or Mary Church Terrell? I mean, are we are we at an advantage if we seek purposely to engage with them differently than we engage with W.E.B. Du Bois or Frederick Douglass or Booker T. Washington?
Well, I'm actually going to turn that around with a question from Brittany, because you say that Black women thinkers have always been intellectuals, and you talk about the embodiment of their intellectualism. Can you talk about what you mean by that? And then I'll circle back around if mm-hmm. need be, but I suspect I won't have to after Brittany talks about that.
Sure. So part of what I argue in this book is that Black women place their bodies in the center of the text. So I argue that this is a deep contrast between someone like Cooper and someone like Du Bois. So we talk about Du Bois' famous thing where he says, the black soul is a sort of striving, warring soul. He talks about this sort of two-ness, this competition between our African heritage and our American heritage, and he says that it threatens to split the black body asunder. And Cooper really talks about the black body differently, and she says, look, the black body is a site of possibility. There's a sort of newness and a kind of new life in this moment of the 1890s where we're in the progressive era, and there's all these sets of possibilities. So even in the midst of massive racial repression, she's talking about the sort of optimism of what it means to be a black woman. And just a decade later, Du Bois is talking about the sort of torturous nature of what it means to try to put these identities together in one body. I think that represents one of the key differences in the way that black men have thought about what it means to move through the American body politic and what black women, how black women typically move, which is to say that black women don't sort of allow themselves to get caught up in the despair. They certainly recognize how bad conditions are, but they're always pushing towards how can we build the future that we want to see. And part of that, Cooper uses the imagery of pregnancy as a way to motivate that kind of claim. And so she's thinking about a kind of female reproductive set of possibilities, not just in terms of making babies, but in terms of a like social reproduction of a kind of black future. And so that's different. It's distinct. It's not the kind of way that black men are typically talking about how to address questions of black freedom. And so that's why I think talking about black women's contribution reminds us that there are all kinds of ideas floating in black communities at any given period about how to solve these problems that we face.
And the reason I wanted all of us to hear you talk about that is that that is how we should approach black women, because the black men who were writing and speaking at the time were very much writing and speaking in the Western mode, where rationality is separate from the emotions and separate from the body. And when white women who were writing and speaking, and there were a few of them, were often, if they spoke of the body, they were often speaking in euphemism. And black women were, as they often are, in a middle space and an allness space where they pull it all together. And I have a brain, I am an intellectual, I have a body, and I can move back and forth between these spheres. And that is, I think,
and not uncomfortable,
right,
having a body that is ruled to a certain extent by emotions and ruled by intellect and ruled by all sorts of factors.
Well, and Brittany used the word very early, love. Mm-hmm. I mean, to have an intellectual say, I love black people, is something that you don't get in quite that blunt a way from black male writers, even though that sentiment might have been there. And one of the things that I think this leads Brittany to say is that we often don't think of black women as leading other intellectuals. And she does make that point.
Mm-hmm. And Brittany Cooper, you talk about Melissa Harris Perry, who could be considered certainly a modern day intellectual like you and Sherry Parks. She is erstwhile of MSNBC. And I guess, is she still on the faculty at Princeton? I'm not sure.
No.
She was there for a while.
Wake Forest.
Yeah.
Wake Forest.
She argues that black women's emotions affect how we engage in politics. I mean, and I wonder if, given, we've had the first woman run for president on a major political party, and she was concerned, she herself was very concerned at being seen in any way as weak or, dare one say it, womanly, and she had to project this strength and stuff. She's a white woman, obviously, and it comes from a very different milieu. But is there a sort of attendant deprecation of a black woman's intellectual capacity given that there's an embrace of the emotional component of that intellectualism?
You know, I think there's ambivalence around emotion. So I tell the story in the book around how Ida B. Wells is mortified the very first time, the famous anti-lynching activist. She's mortified when she gives her first anti-lynching speech in the early 1890s, and she starts crying on stage as she tells these stories of black people who've been lynched because she's worried about the sort of openness or about appearing to be less intellectual or less serious. And so there's a way that black women have a complicated relationship to their emotions. But one of the things I argue is that if you read their autobiographies in particular, that they're much more honest about their struggles with depression, in dealing with racism, that they're much more honest about the kind of fear that they feel when they're out in public and they're worried about sexual harassment at that time period from white men. And so I think it's in some way related to the way that Hillary Clinton, very early in her campaign, is navigating this thing around whether she'll cry in public and folks say, oh, she's not soft. And so then she gives an interview where she cries and then her ratings go up. So there are always a competing set of terms. And black women are navigating that set of demands around emotionality much more acutely even than white women are. But here's the sort of jab that I want to take that I think is important to take is there's a way that black male intellectuals discredit black women or don't pay attention to them or don't think that they're serious. But one of the underlying threads of this book that I'm arguing is that much of what animates black men's own intellectual production is a set of emotions that are rooted in notions of fear and betrayal and ideas of crisis. And so there's a deep discomfort often with what political upheaval means for how black men get to be men. And so often they play this out, this sort of what they call crisis all the time. They play it out by reasserting the importance of black male leadership. And really, there is a fear of displacement, and they often project that fear onto black women. And it's black women who are sort of over here going, let's systematically study the problem. Let's figure out what our people need. Let's go into communities and make it happen. And when we have time to ourselves and our diaries or our autobiographies, we will write about how we feel about that, and we will be honest about that. But we have to solve these problems. It's black men, black male intellectuals, who don't navigate the space between the intellectual and the emotional very well publicly. And unfortunately, they're in ability to do that is to the great detriment of black women.
Dr. Brittany Cooper, she's the author of Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. It's the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks, who joins me here in Studio A. Her very important book in this vein is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. More on the history and influence of early African-American women intellectuals when we return. You can join us at 410-662-8780. You can drop us an email, midday@wypr.org. You can join us on Twitter as well, @MiddayTomHall. Stick around.
This is your NPR news station, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up tomorrow, we're going to meet the new head of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. Heidi Daniel comes to Baltimore from Youngstown, Ohio, and she'll lead the Pratt at a time of significant changes to the Central Library building itself and to the role of libraries in American culture. Heidi Daniel's first day on the job is today, and tomorrow she'll join us here on Midday. Coming up a little later on today's program, we'll speak with Ellen G., an organizer of the Baltimore Ceasefire. And if you've just joined us, it's the Midday Culture Connection. We're talking with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland and Dr. Brittany Cooper of Rutgers University. Our launching point today is Dr. Cooper's book, Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. To join our conversation, give us a buzz at 410-662-8780. You can send us an email, midday@wypr.org, or you can join us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. So, Brittany Cooper, who were these intellectuals in the late 1800s, the beginning of the 20th century? Who was the audience? Who were they writing for?
Sure. So, they're writing for black literate audiences. A lot of times they're writing in church magazines like the AME Church Review. They're writing in Negro Digest if we look later in this time period. They're writing in sort of black magazines, local black newspapers. Ida B. Wells talks a lot about black folks writing in black newspapers, but they're also writing for white audiences. I don't think we need to skirt that issue. They're certainly writing to try to transform the ways in which white people see and understand black folks and black humanity. They're writing for... they assume that there are white readers who are going to be reading and listening to them, and they're also often giving speeches in front of audiences that include both black and white people.
You write about Fannie Barrier Williams, who gave a speech at the 1893 World's Fair talking about women, black women and unemployment. And it's frightening to think how little progress has been made since 1893 when she made that speech. In the second quarter of this year, overall unemployment is 4.2%, but for black women, it's 7.1%. For black men, it's a little higher, 7.5%. But for white women and white men, it's 3.7%. So it's still considerably higher than for Caucasian workers. Black women earn 63 cents on the dollar to white men, and white women earn 77 cents on the dollar to white men. Were they taking up those kinds of causes, and having leadership in those areas that black men was that a particular area, for example, that Fannie Barrier Williams thought it incumbent upon her to bring up because the men were ignoring it?
I think that they thought it incumbent to bring it up because it was something that mattered for black women and girls. So I think it's really important to note that July 31st, yesterday, was Black Women's Equal Pay Day, which is the date this year. So it took us until July 31st, 2017, to make the same amount of money that the average white male citizen made in the year 2016. It took us a full 7 months, almost 8 months into the year 2017, to make what white men made by December 31st last year. So this is a longstanding issue, and black women organizers organized around it. Fannie Barrier Williams was interested in it because she was from Chicago. Chicago was the site of the Great Migration, and so there had been many waves of black people moving up from the South, even beginning in the late 1800s, but certainly by the early part of the 20th century. And these women were on the front lines of trying to help these migrants from the South get assimilated, and they cared very much about the kind of exploitation that these women would experience when they would go to try to work for white employers. And, you know, that even though they might be polished, they might have, you know, gotten some kind of professional training, very often they were still relegated to work as domestic workers. And so this was the kind of advocacy that she was trying to do, and from a largely white audience at the Chicago World's Fair, was to say, stop discriminating against our girls. Don't say that they're lazy, but when they come to you for jobs, then you will only give them to white candidates. And so that still is a problem today. And part of what's happening with black men is that, by and large, black men always make their advocacy about violence primarily, and about black men's ability to access the vote, black men's ability to access employment, because many black men, though not all of them, many black men believed that the way to make black communities stronger was for black men to be able to be employed and to be breadwinners and to perform really traditional kinds of masculine roles. The problem doing that in that time period was that black men were being actively, violently pushed out of the public sphere. So even if black women sort of sympathized with their plight, pragmatically, that couldn't happen. And so black women were saying, look, we have to be a part of this, not just because of sexism, but because if you all are getting killed, if you're being threatened with the potential of lynching just for trying to assert your rights, then we have to stand alongside you and try to make these conditions better.
Brittany, you just talked about the vulnerability of black women, and I think we need to circle back to the title, Beyond Respectability, because it may not be clear to all of the audience why that is the main title of your book. Can you talk about the politics of respectability and how it fits into this argument?
Sure. And Dr. Parks, I just have to say that I'm a big fan of your work. And the thing that it reminded me was always to look in unexpected places for Black women's contributions, right? That there's a way that Black women can be a part of the landscape and can be hiding in plain view, and we can miss them. And so that's a lesson that I learned from reading Fierce Angels when I was in my first year as a professor. So I really appreciate that.
Thank you.
So respectability politics is a strategy that that Black people pioneered during the Reconstruction era, the end of Reconstruction after the Civil War, because they were dealing with the threat of violence, particularly from angry Southern whites. And they were like, how can we protect ourselves? The government is not going to help us. What can we do? And so they said, what we can do is we can become educated. We can be articulate. We can make sure that we never commit any crime. We can try to be perfect, upstanding citizens. And in that way, we can prove that we are worthy of protection, that we are human beings, that our humanity is worthy of protecting. And so they began to style themselves as respectable, which really matters in a world where Black women are dealing acutely with the threat of rape, not only by being like snatched up off the street, but even when they would go into white homes to do domestic labor. So this a need to project a kind of overarching sense of propriety became really important to Black folks' survival. But the reason that I wanted to argue in this book beyond mm-hmm. that paradigm is because Black women, many scholars often thought that these Black women who were obsessed with respectability were snooty and elitist, because many of them were. They often looked down on working class Black folks who either could not or were not interested in performing respectability to the same extent, and often talked about how those folks could be weighing down the race and making it harder to, as the, you know, club women, Black club women like to say, lift as we climb. But I wanted to argue that that wasn't the full story, that even though these women had really sort of terrible class politics in some moments, they always knew that there was a limit to trying to make yourself look pretty and respectable in order to prevent violence. And so they were never just using that as the primary mode of Black freedom. It was always a strategy for them. And these women were always agitating for white people to change, for white people to combat racism, for men to combat sexism so that conditions could be better for all Black people. And sometimes they use respectability as a strategy to do it, but we certainly shouldn't relegate them to the role of only being interested in respectability, because that's too limited a reading of the kind of dynamism of these women.
And you also write about how it's often how dignity and respectability are often conflated, and the aspiration for dignity and the aspiration for respectability thought of as the same. But you argue that they're not the same. What in your mind is the distinction?
Sure. Dignity is inherent. It's intrinsic. It is assumed. It is not up for debate. And the reason that you'll see folks acting undignified, I think of Corrin Gaines in Baltimore, right? I think about the outrage over Freddie Gray, is when folks challenge your fundamental dignity and right to be treated as a human being and to be treated with respect. Respectability is a strategy that is designed to say we are non-threatening, and to make the argument, right, that if we look respectable, perhaps you will see our intrinsic dignity. And part of the reason we need to begin to make this distinction, because sometimes you'll hear folks saying, you know, well, you know, act dignified, act in a dignified manner. And the thing that we need to be saying is that it should not matter what you wear or how educated you are or how you talk or where you went to school or where you live. When you're having interactions in your daily life, whether those whether with politicians, whether with the President of the United States or with law enforcement, that you should always be treated with a modicum of dignity and respect no matter what. And you shouldn't have to act respectable or have a sort of hyper-propriety about yourself in order to achieve that. And I think that the women in this study did understand that distinction. They talked a lot about respectability in a world where it was so clear that their dignity was not going to be conceded. It's the reason why Anna Julia Cooper says in this famous quote of hers that only the Black woman can say when and where I enter in the quiet, undisputed dignity of my womanhood. Then and there, the whole race enters with me. And so she says, look, our dignity is always under dispute, and that's why we're shifting to this respectability thing as a strategy. But let us all be clear in this contemporary moment that these are not the same thing. And what are we asking people to do when we start preaching at them about how they need to be civil and dignified, even in the face of massive kinds of outrage and injustice?
It's the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks. I'm Tom Hall. On the line from Rutgers University is Dr. Brittany Cooper. Her latest book is called Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall. Sherry Parks, Brittany Cooper makes the point in her book that oftentimes intellectuals are thought of as activists, not thinkers. And of course, these early black intellectual women, public intellectuals, were not associated with the academy. We have things like Black Lives Matter, which was, you know, founded and animated in large part by women. Does it matter that intellectual life and public intellectuals, public black women intellectuals, are in the academy, out of the academy? Should we care about it one way or the other?
Well, I mean, certainly historically, black women did not have a lot of entry into the academy.
Sure.
You know, clearly, what's interesting about your question is that clearly Brittany and I are both in the academy.
Yeah.
So this is a conversation.
As a matter of fact, you are.
About ourselves. So we have to point that out. I think it matters in terms of credibility. I mean, we are undisputedly intellectual. Brittany and I have to fight for the public part of that, because the academy would be very happy if we just stayed in the academy. So
right.
Black women have always moved back and forth between the women that Brittany's writing about, between elite spaces, whether that's the academy or not, and less elite spaces. So we have the ability to move back and forth. I think when you begin to get more and more black women with PhDs, I will call myself a black academic feminist, and that means a specific thing, and I bring a certain set of skills to it. It also makes me suspicious. I mean, it makes people suspect me in a certain way. And certainly black women writers, both in the early years and continuing, have to fight. Brittany has this wonderful quote that they were not, she's quoting someone, not experts of their own social condition.
Right.
So that idea that you're writing about yourself is very suspect in the academy. So it's a very complicated position that we exist in.
Yeah, oh, it is complicated, that's for sure. I mean, Brittany Cooper, you make an interesting observation that I found one of many fascinating observations, and that was the importance in the 1970s. You talk about how Shirley Chisholm, Barbara Jordan were elected to Congress. Toni Morrison and Maya Angelou had their first novels. Angela Davis was on the FBI's most wanted list. I mean, there was there were a lot of black women who had high public profiles. When we talk about the Academy, of which you and Dr. Parks are members, it's 3% of faculty of the 1.5 million people who serve on the faculties at degree-granting universities, 3% are black women.
Wow. Yeah. This is the distinction that I wanted to make between intellectuals and activists. It's that the problem with calling black women activists and not remembering their intellectual contributions is that we're fine with their bodily labor and not okay with the kind of intellectual work that they put forward. So when we think about the 60s and 70s and we think about social movements, the civil rights movement, the black power era, these days we have good, credible histories that talk to us about the black women who undergirded and provided the critical labor of those movements, women like Ella Baker and Anna Arnold Hedgeman, Pauli Murray, who's a key figure in this book, all of these women who do this kind of heavy lifting but do it largely out of the public sphere, while there are men who are sort of getting all the shine and being talked about as the kind of key theorists and strategists of these movements. And so for me, it's not about devaluing the work of activist women, because in this moment it's so abundantly clear how much we need black women who will put their bodies on the line for the cause of black freedom. But it is to say that there is so much intellectual work that goes into doing this kind of work. I mean, Angela Davis also has a PhD, right? Martin Luther King Jr. also had a PhD. And so even the false distinctions that we sometimes want to make, that Dr. Parks gestures toward around the way that academic feminists become seen as elitist and are looked at as being suspect, what is really true is that we have a long tradition of occupying both spaces of being scholars and activists at the same time.
Yes.
And what I wanted to point to was that everyone is really comfortable in this moment saying, oh, look at how black women really, you know, built these movements and did all of this labor. And yet when you ask these folks, what are these black women's contributions, they can never tell you anything about the content of their thought, the robust concepts that they came up with, the court cases that they fought, the intellectual groundwork that they laid in organizations to train other people. That intellectual labor is really important when we think about what kind of concepts invigorate how we're thinking about the project of freedom for all Americans and particularly for black folks.
Got to take a little break. Dr. Brittany Cooper's new book is called Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. Dr. Cooper joins us on the line from the campus of Rutgers University in New Brunswick, New Jersey, where she is an assistant professor of women's and gender studies and Africana studies. Dr. Sherry Parks is with me here in Studio A. She joins us every month for the Midday Culture Connection. She's on the faculty of the University of Maryland in College Park, and her book is called Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Speaking of activism, we're going to talk to an activist, Ellen G., after a break. She is one of the organizers behind Baltimore Ceasefire. Our phone number when we return, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. Join us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Thanks for listening. Stick around.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for joining us for Midday. If you have just tuned in, on the line from Rutgers University in New Jersey is Dr. Brittany Cooper. She's the author of Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. Dr. Sherry Parks joins me here in the studio, as she does every month for the Midday Culture Connection. She's on the faculty at the University of Maryland College Park, where she teaches in the Department of American Studies, and she's the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. To join our conversation, our phone number, 410-662-8780, our Twitter handle, @MiddayTomHall, and our email, midday@wypr.org. We're going to turn now to Ellen G., who joins us on the phone. She, along with Erica Bridgeford and other community activists, have organized the Baltimore Ceasefire this weekend. Ellen G., welcome to Midday. Thanks for your time.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So tell us about the Baltimore Ceasefire. What do you hope to achieve, and what's going to happen?
So the Baltimore Ceasefire is essentially a community-led, Baltimore City resident-led opportunity for people in Baltimore to have a reprieve from violence. It's known that somebody is murdered in Baltimore City once every 19 hours. So we as citizens and residents of Baltimore City decided that we wanted to call for other citizens in the city to try to accomplish the goal of having 72 hours with no violence. And the way that we plan to accomplish that goal is by creating what we call life-affirming events. Life-affirming events can mean anything from a community cleanup to a neighborhood cookout to we're holding a peace walk the Sunday to begin closing out the ceasefire. And our goal is to create both awareness and to stimulate conversations about violence in the city and what it means for us and how it affects us.
And Ellen, I think I want to show that you are, as I said to you, a perfect embodiment of what Brittany is talking about. That, I mean, just in what you just said, because when you talk about Black death, it reminds me of the early public intellectuals who were often anti-lynching advocates, but also, rather than, as Brittany has said earlier in the show, operating from a position of fear, you are operating from a position of hope. And immediately turning it around and saying, what can we do to make this happen differently? And as I have witnessed your ability to move back and forth between what is happening on the street and larger macro structural issues, can you talk about how you contextualize Black death in Baltimore?
So for me, Black death in Baltimore is a reflection of a lot of things. One of those things is the what it means to feel powerless and what it means to try to mimic what we believe is power as it's been dictated and modeled in American culture. Black death for me is a reminder of systemic racism. It is a reminder of the devaluation of what it means to be Black in America and how messaging and imaging can be poured into a people so insidiously that they don't believe that they have inherent value as human beings.
And Brittany, can I just hear your reaction to that?
So I want to thank you, sis, for this work. Just because this is the work that actually saves our people and makes it possible for them to live and thrive. And my work is really about saying that the argument behind that, right, the way that you say, you know, we're going to put together life-affirming events, right, we want to change the kind of messaging that people get about their social value because we feel like if we change the messaging, then people will begin to embody a different mode of livelihood. That is the core argument of my book, that Black women have known for a long time that if they could change the discourses that shape Black life, if they could change the way that the world thinks about Black people and that Black people think about themselves, then we can begin to embody a different set of realities and we can begin the work of moving towards a Black future in which Black folks live and thrive and where their humanity is respected. And so there is so much wonderful thinking that is happening at the core of this kind of work that you're doing, and there is not this disconnect. There is a clear sense that we can put theory into action, that if we believe that Black lives matter, then this is the way that we can actually make those things happen every day on the ground. And so it's important to me, and it's the reason that I end my book talking about all of the many activists who have made up the movement for Black lives as a way to say activists are intellectuals too. Activists are doing some of our best thinking about how to solve these problems, and we need to, and Black women are at the fore of that, and we need to value their intellectual work.
I agree. And I actually would like to say that so I feel like the work that you do, I was actually having a conversation with one of my friends on social media prior to coming onto the interview. I was listening to your work, and I was telling her about how as a Black woman who is passionate about Black people and about Black womanhood, how I don't feel like I'm an intellectual. I know that I'm a person who doesn't mind putting boots to the ground and doing the work and stimulating conversations and getting people to think about, again, the messaging and the things that we've been told about ourselves. And what I can appreciate about the work that you do and people like you do is that you give me, so I feel like you feed information into me that I can then process and communicate to people on the ground level that I go out and speak to every day. So we all play a very major role in the saving of Black lives and in the saving of Black women who go out into the community and put in this work to save our community. But I appreciate you both for the work that you do.
Yeah, Sherry?
Well, and I just wanted to point out that I did a pivot, but I did a pivot because I've heard Ellen speak before. We moved away from violence in the street to Black death, which is itself an abstraction. It's a larger, more general term and allows Ellen to speak in ways that I've heard her talk about death in the African-American culture. So Ellen, think that you are an intellectual, but I understand that you are answering Tom's question about the difference between the woman in the academy and one who is not.
Yeah.
Right.
And Ellen, do you think, as you and the other organizers of this event, as women, are going to have particular sway, are going to have particular strength to the argument, because so many, I mean, more than 90% of the victims, and we read their names every Monday on this program. Yesterday, we read one name of a woman and then seven men who were just killed last week. They're largely men who are being killed and doing the killing. Is there a particular, you know, a capacity for change that you have, you and the organizers have as women in this conversation?
I think that there is a certain level of empathy that we are able to tap into being women, I think that there is a certain level of compassion that we've been socialized to exalt. So the women, and there are two men involved in the organizing team, but speaking specifically to your question about the women, I think that just the way that we approach activism is based on both balance and compassion. And that's not to say that men don't approach it that way, but I think that women, because we've been conditioned and socialized to think about how what we do impacts other people as well as ourselves, I think that it gives us an advantage in the sense that when we hear people be dismissive, when we hear people talk aggressively about the people who are committing these crimes, we can give them a different perspective that humanizes people. Because again, when we other and dehumanize people, that doesn't help to solve the problem. And at the end of the day, we're really interested in addressing and solving the problem.
And Brittany Cooper, what do you make of the distinction that many Black intellectual women have made, calling themselves womenists instead of feminists? And how does the Black intellectual movement of today, of which you and Sherry and sorry, Ellen, we're going to put you in that too, are part, how does that line up with feminism in general? I mean, I wonder what you make of the clear tensions that existed around the Women's March in January, the day after the inauguration, where there were some clear differences of opinion and tension between Black activists, Black women, community organizers, and some of the white women who were also organizing that event.
Yeah, it's a good question and one that I find myself discussing quite a bit. So there's womanism, which is a term Alice Walker invented to talk about Black women who are feminists, and then there's feminism or Black feminism. So here's what I'll say. If we're in the street and we're trying to, we're protesting, we're doing work, we're organizing, I don't care about these labels. I care about the content of your politics and whether you think that all Black lives matter. If we're having more sort of precise discussions, that can help us to refine our politics, then I say to people that I'm a Black feminist. I don't particularly identify as a womanist. That's not any shade to Alice Walker, whose work I greatly respect. It is a way to occupy the category of feminism and to say that it is not, white women did not invent feminism. White women are not the sole arbiters of what feminism means. And it is a way to say that I'm part of a tradition of Black women who have been theorizing about gender equality and about the problems of patriarchy for as long as Black women have been able to get on the mic in any way. They have talked about the plight of Black women and girls and how that needs to be central to our freedom project. I think that's feminist work. I think it demands that label. And I think that there's a way that claiming the term feminism, particularly when I'm in a room of men, you know, often in rooms of Black men where they just know that we're going to have a race-first analysis, and then I say, well, I'm a feminist, right? It's very disruptive in a
right.
lovely way.
Well, Brittany Cooper, we're going to have to make that the last word. We appreciate your joining us today and very fascinated by the book Beyond Respectability, The Intellectual Thought of Race Women. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Ellen G. is one of six organizers of the Baltimore ceasefire. They're calling for no murders between Friday and Sunday. There's a peace and healing walk that's going to launch from Frederick Douglass High School Saturday morning at 8:30. There's a peace vigil and walk from the Shot Tower to City Hall Sunday afternoon at 1 o'clock. A whole bunch of other events, and we'll have a link to information about all of them at our website, wypr.org/midday. Ellen G., thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This has been the Midday Culture Connection with Dr. Sherry Parks of the University of Maryland. She is the author of Fierce Angels, Living with a Legacy from the Sacred Dark Feminine to the Strong Black Woman. Sherry, thank you. We'll see you next time.
Thank you.
That's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to introduce you to the new president and CEO of the Enoch Pratt Free Library. Her name is Heidi Daniels. She's got big shoes to fill as she succeeds Dr. Carla Hayden, another strong Black woman who left Baltimore last year to become the Librarian of Congress. So Heidi Daniels will join me here in Studio A tomorrow on Midday. I want to thank Joe Squared for providing lunch today. Joe Squared serves coal-fired pizzas, risotto, and local craft beers. Locations and hours at Joe Squared. WIPR.com. A quick programming note, if you're a fan of WIPR's award-winning documentary series Out of the Blocks, Aaron and Wendell have just dropped a new podcast episode this morning. It's full of stories about falls from grace and paths to redemption on the 1100 block of Ward Street in Southwest Baltimore. Out of the Blocks, so check it out wherever you get your podcasts. Next up on the radio, it's Here and Now after a break for news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.